know David. I used to play cricket with David.
Did you?
We went to school together.
I'll say hello for me. I saw him not long ago for lunch.
Yeah, Oggy's he's a very talented cricketer.
I've heard. And a potato farmer.
I didn't know that bit.
Yeah, Yorkshireman. But yeah, I think his family are potato farmers, right. I think.
No. Yeah.
Fan of that.
And you, who else? You've got Mark Wilkinson as well, one of the market makers.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good guys around there.
Yeah, Oggy's lovely man.
There's not many people he doesn't know. So your cricket going all right?
Yeah, I'm playing tonight. Yeah. T20 up in Potter's Bar.
Lovely evening for it.
It's definitely a 4-over evening rather than a 10-over evening, isn't it? T20 is definitely my...
What's your forte? You bat a bowler?
Well, back when I played at school, I was a bowler who batted 11. Okay. And I went through my first 11, upper sixth season. And I scored 2 runs the entire season. Partly because our batting was very good and I barely got to bat. But the one time I did bat, they were actually leg byes. The umpire gave us runs. Okay. I was that much of a rabbit. But now, I mean, I bat 3 for my club side. But I don't really bowl, so I've sort of reinvented myself. I would describe myself as having 2 shots, a very, very effective forward defensive, and the clear the front leg and send it over the counter. And both shots are excellent, but I just basically decided as he's running, the bowler's running in about 3 feet, about 3 steps away. I'll decide, is it going to be the block or is it going to be the shot?
He'd rather the party shot though every time, of course.
Absolutely.
My cricket career has had a renaissance, played loads when I was a kid and all the way through school. And I sort of stopped at university, I played the odd game in my 20s, but now my 5-year-olds just started All-Stars cricket on a Friday night, which by the way is the best thing ever. It's just glorified childcare for the parents to have a load of drinks and a cricket club. We've now been playing garden cricket and I absolutely love it. And I'm like, he's quite happy with his bowling.
Do you bounce your 5-year-old?
No, I let him bowl and then I just sort of settle in for the afternoon.
Get past that.
Don't mind. Yeah. Don't mind if I do. So, no, it's good fun though. So I haven't yet told my wife, and she definitely won't watch this to know, but I haven't told my wife that I'm probably going to start playing cricket again, which maybe.
So hang on,
maybe.
So golf and cricket.
Don't tell anyone.
Gosh. You're brave.
We'll see. No, maybe not yet, but maybe in June.
Doesn't Mrs. Raymond listen to this?
We'll find out, won't we? right, well, should we get cracking? We've got, a few things to talk about in the land of UK.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to episode 32 of Taking Stock After the Bell. Pleased to be joined by Simon French. Simon is the Managing Director and Head of Research at Panmure Gordon. He joined the firm as Chief Economist in 2015. Before this, he had a distinguished career in the UK government, serving at the Cabinet Office as Chief of Staff to the Government Chief Operating Officer. His government service also included a role in implementing the coalition government spending reforms from 2010 to 2014. Simon gained an MSc in Economics and Finance from Durham University. He writes a fortnightly column for The Times and appears regularly across the media, including all podcasts, etc. And he enjoys cricket and in his spare time is also a beekeeper. Simon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you here.
What a lineup you've given me.
Where do we start with that?
Exactly.
Where do we start?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, being Chief Economist at Panmure Gordon, policy making experience, markets, economic experience, I thought we'd try and avoid the election. Oh, well, we weren't trying to avoid the election, but I thought, the purpose of today really was kind of twofold. Get the kind of lie of the land of the UK economy a bit and sort of see where we are and maybe try and counter some of the kind of UK doomerism that's around the place. Is that fair?
Very fair.
And then secondly, towards the end, maybe we'll talk a bit about the UK equity market and, you've done a bit of work on UK PLC, the market as a whole, number of companies in the market, valuations, the Mansion House reforms, etc. We'll sort of touch on that towards the end and then we'll see how it goes from there. So
a lot to get through, but important topics.
Absolutely right, especially with an election on the agenda. So we've got a few slides that we've pulled together here. I think we'll probably start with the kind of topic du jour, really, inflation. Chart here, UK CPI, headline CPI in blue, back to the kind of magical 2%. Albeit within the details, most of that disinflation that we've seen in the last 18 months or so has come from goods prices, which are now running in a kind of negative year on year at 1.3%, whereas services inflation is running at a kind of still relatively high 5.7%. So encouraging news. How do you think the Bank of England see this, or, you know, what's your view in terms of the unwinding and the inflation story in the last year or so?
Okay, so let's take the unwinding first, and it's good news. The UK 12 to 18 months ago, had we been recording this podcast, was seen on international markets amongst international investors, and indeed investors and economists closer to home, as something of an inflation outlier. There were broker notes doing the rounds about the UK going back to the sort of 1970s outsized inflationary experience. I took a view that this was principally a timing issue, the timing of which energy, which drove so much of the inflation we saw in 2022-23, the timing through which it was passed through because of the construct of the UK energy market and the energy price cap. And I posited it 12 months, 18 months ago, that what we'd see then is some much bigger base effects into 24, bringing inflation down and indeed undershooting the G20 average. And if you take that chart and you look at the UK now at 2% annual CPI, the G20 average is 3.1%. I don't see what I would describe as symmetrical commentary saying, gosh, isn't the UK undershooting this inflationary picture?
Yeah.
I get, look, you very kindly in the introduction mentioned the sort of media stuff I do. I get that there isn't as much media attention on, if you like, good news or outperformance. But I do think all of us active in financial markets need to give it its balance. And the UK now, through the rest of 2024, is likely to continue to undershoot global inflation. And then bring on to the part of your question surrounding the Bank of England, how does it interpret that? Well, I think it now has a narrative to be able to trim interest rates once, maybe twice this year, while continuing, like the Bank of Canada has done, the Swiss National Bank has done, the Riksbank has done, still saying we're being restrictive, but trimming it from the level 5.25% that was necessary when inflation was double digits. Do I think they can go on a big cutting cycle given that sticky services inflation you mentioned? No, I don't think they can. So to some extent, some trimming from those high levels, but not yet the confidence that persistent services and wage inflation will come down to levels consistent with 2% once those disinflationary impacts from energy and shipping have flushed through.
And the services inflation, then that's mainly because wages are still growing at a relatively healthy clip, and the service sector, you know, coffee shops, restaurants, businesses, etc., still catching up to what's come through?
It is, but again, look, it's the right question to ask, because I think there's something of a misdiagnosis here, because wage inflation, the way traditional economic models approach this, is they go, well, high nominal and now real terms wage inflation must be because of a tight labour market. It must be the strong bargaining power of labour bidding up wages. That's the workhorse model that most central banks, most academic economists, most professional independent economists look at it. However, I look at it slightly differently. And I look at this as the echo effect of very high headline inflation, meaning the workers are, with a lag, trying to keep up with the erosion they've had in the purchasing power of their income. And yes, that is enhanced a little bit by bargaining power. But as that headline rate comes down, so I think it brings services and wages inflation down. So we think that wage inflation will run about 4.25% by the end of the summer, which is much more consistent with a 2% inflation target. The other thing I would just add on in terms of the wages pitch is the degree to which this is policy driven through the National Living Wage, and you mentioned restaurants, hospitality. The fact that the National Living Wage went up 9.8% in April is a key determinant of this. And this isn't a measure of economic slack, that's of regulation of low pay and a persistent policy shift. I think you mentioned, when we may or may not talk much about the election, big policy question for the Bank of England is if it is to be an incoming Labour government, what are they going to do on the National Living Wage in April 2025? Because that'll be a big determinant of core inflation into next year.
Yeah, and that living wage theme, because it pushes wages up not just for those on the living wage, but if you're one grade above. The differentials are going to push you up. And I remember Next, easy, you might remember this time last year, Next had a trading statement that covered April 2023, and they remarked how strong April trading was compared to March. Mm-hmm. And normally retailers blame the weather or not blame the weather, but it was put down specifically to the fact that benefits, pensions, wages had gone up step change from 1st of April, which is when the living wage, mm-hmm. and most people get their wage rises. Mm-hmm. And they had a really strong month in April as a result. So humans are supposed to be rational actors, aren't we? And we should all price these things in. But we get, a 10% pay rise and off we get down to, buy a new pair of shoes or whatever it is.
We had a clue of this from the United States back in January, both January this year and January last year, because they do their cost of living adjustment in January.
Yeah.
And blow out US retail sales in January. Yeah. And obviously, weather affected often, that cyclical data in the US in the US winter is affected. But we saw that a big nominal push through of cost of living adjustments or COLAs had a big boost. So I'm not surprised. Nobody really should have been surprised, because if you do UK macroeconomics well, you've got to recognise that there are a lot of the trends we see on inflation, interest rates, retail patterns, we can see in other big economies. So we have to calibrate against other data sets, other recurring themes. And I thought there was a good one, a leading indicator of what was going on in the US that was then going to recur in that important part of the economy.
COLAs, cost of living adjustment. That hadn't crossed my mind. But good one. I like that. And then, the Bank of England, a couple of cuts this year, you're suggesting. And then, how, if we take a step back a bit, and this is a question we often ask, we know the reasons. We didn't have a recession when rates went from 0 to 5% because our mortgages are fixed and we had savings in the pandemic and the labour market remains tight and wage growth coming through. Is that still a risk that actually you can't go from 15 years of 0% rates to 4 or 5% rates and expect the economy? And when we technically had a recession in the UK, but we kind of didn't really.
Sure.
Are we going to sail serenely through that adjustment period of 0 to 5%?
We're probably unwinding a bit, aren't we, as we come to the end of fixed mortgages and things like that?
So there's a couple of things going on here, which is the average interest rate on the UK's £1.5 trillion mortgage book is still just 3.6%.
3.6.
Okay, so good luck going down to your high street lender anytime soon and getting a 3.6% deal. It tells you there's still a significant part. We think about a third of the mortgage stock is still on pre-2022 interest rates. And therefore, those households have still got to meet their refi moments. I used this line before, so apologise for repeating it, but the people you see smiling as you walk down the street are the people who are on their five-year fixed deals.
And you?
Look at you. You're both smiling.
I'm envy. I love
you. But that won't, I'm sorry to depress you both, as you well know, it won't last forever. No, and therefore, that ratchet effect, what the central bankers, monetary policymakers would call the transmission mechanism, hasn't gone away. Mm. It's just been elongated. Mm. Now, you mentioned rational expectations. The big debate is whether households are rational, whether you know that refi is coming and therefore you've already pared back your consumption.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there is some evidence of that, because the UK household savings rate, which normally averages about 8.5%, is north of 10% at the moment.
Yeah, it does look very healthy, isn't it?
And therefore, while on one level, that's quite good. That's households building up savings, adding to that stock of £1.8 trillion worth of cash or near cash deposits. But in the short term, consumption spending, which is two-thirds of GDP, is being depressed because people are saving rather than consuming, and therefore the multiplier through the economy is less. So it's a big judgment call when you're doing UK macro into the second half of the year. Will those leading indicators from consumer confidence, which is at a near 3-year high, business confidence at an 8-year high, whether they are telling you that actually households and businesses will feel a more confident and will push down that savings rate, or whether, knowing that there's still some refi to come through tighter monetary policy, are still going to put some money away for that rainy day that will eventually come.
There's a couple of commentators in the US, and this is specific on the US economy, and I don't agree with this, but they're trying to suggest that the world has changed so much in the US that a higher interest rate has actually been inflationary, because savings exceed net debt. And that's quite an interesting, I think it's less so here because our debt is fixed to a shorter term. But in the US, it is quite amusing that it could actually be
If we were on 30-year fixed rate mortgages at 3%, we'd be laughing all the way.
And the school of economics that is neo-Fisherian economics, the idea that higher interest rates actually generate higher inflation. I think if it was solely the household sector, then that argument could stack up in terms of the pass-through to higher savings interest and then some spending, while the marginal propensity to consume of those who receive savings income is not as high as those who have their income taken away because of higher debt servicing costs. You could make the argument because of the composition that works. I think the bit that argument falls down is how businesses perceive this and what the cost of capital does to the hurdle rate for investment, which of course is another big part of the economic picture. It's not as big as the consumer, but it's a very relevant aspect. And the message that sends on, you know, hurdle rates for new investment, changes the net present value calculation for new investments. Yeah, I think that's the deflationary aspect of monetary policy that's still pretty intact.
I mean, the other thing I often think about is since we sort of went into this inflationary period, I think inflation is up over 20%.
The price level, yes.
Yeah, and wages just haven't increased that much on average.
They have. They've gone up more than 25%. So over the period since January 2020, the average, take the average weekly earnings data in the UK, it's up 25%. The price level is up 23%. So actually, in real terms, the wage is 2% higher today than it was at the start of the pandemic.
So you've taken away my argument of actually things are more expensive and actually that's why the inflation level is falling off, but or it's starting to go back to your 2% level off. But that's phenomenal, actually. I hadn't appreciated that.
There's a bit of a distributional impact though, isn't it? Because there are winners and losers, because not everybody will have seen their wages go up. And interestingly, those at the lower end.
I think we need to have a word with that.
Chief exec might be watching.
You're absolutely right. There were some big compositional changes of the workforce during furlough that artificially inflated wage inflation. Yeah. But that is largely unwound as the demand patterns have readjusted and where jobs are and people have moved off furlough. What you are, though, seeing is, you're absolutely right, real terms income growth, and this is both sides of the Atlantic, has been far more significant in the bottom two income quintiles, the bottom 40% of the population, than it has in the top 60%. So it's a very bifurcated picture and quite a progressive picture. This is why, I mean, I know this is largely a podcast about the UK economy, but Bidenomics, one of the reasons why Bidenomics is deemed to have failed by a large part of the sort of commentariat in the US is the socioeconomic groupings of that commentary class have not benefited from Bidenomics, whereas actually the people who don't get a big stake in US commentary, the lower income groups, have done very, very well from stimulus checks, from Bidenomics, from growth of their
incomes. Which makes you wonder why there's the push for a change of government on both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, we don't know the answer in the US and there's different factors, but I mean, certainly in the UK, if it's the lower portions and the majority, but
well, I this is where I do think your point on cumulative price growth is very relevant. Economists might like to think about inflation rates. I think most people I talk to who are not economists go prices are up a quarter or best part of a quarter, and in some areas much greater or some areas much lower, and that feels like a really difficult backdrop to give credit to economic governance, be it central banks or be it the governments themselves. I think what's also quite interesting is where we're seeing consumption still pretty robust is high frequency purchases, you know, in terms of food spending, you know, consumer goods, holidays, travel, leisure. Where we are seeing caution, you see this very clearly in the GfK consumer confidence data, is the aspect that asks you about your appetite for big ticket item purchases. That's the lagging part of that composition. And if you try and understand why, I think it is because if you do a purchase, big ticket item purchase, maybe once every 2 or 3 years, you've come back to something, you've gone, hang on, that's a quarter, best part of a quarter, more expensive than it was, and often more than that. And you go, gosh, that is a real big shock, and therefore I'm going to put off my consumption.
I mean, it's just, you just take one sector, you know, you just take the car industry and look at what a new car costs. I mean, it's unbelievably expensive to what it was not that long ago.
And insurance. I mean, motor insurance, yeah. Both sides of the Atlantic. You're talking about what's driving that. I mean, yes, we talk about wages and stuff, but insurance, motor insurance, yeah. Extraordinary price growth
yeah.
there.
Yeah. And then to finish on sort of UK macro short term, and then we've got some long term bits to discuss. I mean, unemployment in the UK has ticked up a little bit off the mm-hmm. lows. I mean, it's still kind of generationally low, I guess, for, what is it, 4.3, 4.4%, yep. there or thereabouts, mm-hmm. up from 3.5%. And the employment rate, this is the proportion of those aged 16 to 64 in work, has not recouped pre-pandemic levels. It's about 75% today, which is what we call a participation rate, I would assume.
Yes.
Yeah. Having been 76, 77. Is that sort of, you know, the tick up in the unemployment rate, is that something that economists and the Bank of England and policymakers might get a bit concerned about? Is this, and it's happening in the US as well. So, you know, is this just normalization from a tight labour market, or is it something potentially a bit more concerning?
Well, look, I think both the employment and unemployment picture in the UK are consistent with higher interest rates, slowing the economy, mm-hmm. slowing demand, trying to bring inflation down. So it's the transmission you would expect
yep.
and hope for. But when you're looking at the UK labour market, what is the standout feature at the moment? It isn't, with great respect to that chart, it's not the employment rate, it's not the unemployment rate, it's the inactivity rate.
Yeah, well.
And it is the fact that we have 9.4 million people who are working age inactive. And you have a chart there.
I have a chart right
fantastic.
Here. Fantastic.
because this is the big, if you like, challenge. And when we're talking about trying to get growth back into yeah. the economy, we can talk about infrastructure, we can talk about skills, we can talk about lots of things. But getting, if you like, anything up to a million people who are working age inactive but have had a recent attachment to the labour market pre-pandemic back into work. Think about the productive potential that has
yep.
for UK companies, for aggregate growth, consumer spending, etc. That's the looming policy challenge. And if you're trying to decompose what the big UK labour market challenge is, I don't think it's the relatively modest uptick in unemployment. It is the sheer number of people who are not presenting yeah. themselves as fit for work.
Yeah, and the chart here we've got, the blue line is the number of people on long-term sick. And you can see that that's basically a million people, half a million people more. In fact, this is just male. Mm-hmm. But you can see the trend of late and exacerbated by the pandemic. And then the top line, the yellow line, is the number of people in education aged 16 to 24. And obviously that's moved around because of the pandemic a little bit. And there's some, you know, people put off going into education and then they ended up going back into education. So there's, I'd say long-term sick and the number of people not presenting themselves in the labour force is, you know, a seismic economic issue.
And there's a further part to this story, which is older workers. So mm-hmm. one of the great success stories, although you know, my social media account sometimes tells me it's not a success story, but I think it is, which is that older workers, and that's classified, I mean, I began my career at DWP, Department of Work and Pensions, working on a policy called Extending Working Lives, yeah. trying to encourage people in the latter end, age-wise, of their working career,
yeah.
staying in the labour market longer. That's good for their lifetime earnings, it's good for their health outcomes, it's good for a whole variety of these skills in the economy, etc. We'd made great progress as a country over two decades.
Mm.
That has stalled,
right.
really, just completely flatlined since the pandemic.
Right.
And there's an element of lifestyle choice there. You know, people coming towards the end of their working career, considering whether they want to stay at work. But there is also perhaps something of a wealth effect because asset prices, largely in UK housing,
yeah.
rose very appreciably in that race for space on UK property. And as a result, perhaps some people feel they have a sufficient wealth to be able to stay outside of the labour market at the end of their working career rather than remaining engaged with
occupation. Mean, clients at Quilt Achieve, you know, who've had very good outcomes over the last few years, are in a very strong position to retire. So, you know, well done then. Well done, Yuzi. Pat yourself
well
on the back.
Done. Well done.
No, I think that is interesting. And we were making, you're right, people were working longer, but now maybe some of that's health issues as well, kind of mm-hmm. ticking into the data. Maybe some of that's, you know, lifestyle choice. I want to go traveling because yep. I might not get a chance because we might be shut down for 2 years or whatever it was that we mm-hmm. couldn't travel for. So I think that, is that... I'm just thinking out loud here. Is that something that the government should be actively encouraging people to stay and work longer? I don't know. ultimately, it's up to them, isn't it, as a libertarian in me?
Your libertarian instincts are unimpeachable. The one thing I would say is, from as a dispassionate macroeconomist, lots of the challenges regarding skills, growth, capacity, tax receipts, etc., are enhanced by encouraging people to stay and work longer. Yeah. Don't want any. I mean, I'm not like sort of perhaps Rishi Sunak with his encouragement towards national service. But you know, if it's good at one end of the age distribution, why isn't it necessarily good at the other end? Yeah. Anyway, danger of getting roped into politics here.
Yeah, we'll try and stay away from that.
this should be a massive policy, shouldn't it, in terms of trying to get long term sick back in.
And we've done it before. Although there's 9.4 million people working age inactive, that number nominally has been higher. That number as a proportion has been much higher, actually, as recently as the early 2000s. But we do know that, and I speak with some experience because I've worked on these policies, tailored support for those people who are, have multiple needs to get them work ready, be it occupational health, be it retraining, be it tailored, New Deal style. Think about the New Deal programs under New Labour in the late 90s, early 2000s. Those were very effective in getting cohorts who we thought were hard to help, people who maybe as a result of deindustrialisation in the UK, particularly in northern Midlands regions, got them back into work. But it wasn't simple. It wasn't simply pull one lever in terms of fiscal incentives. It needs to be multifaceted in terms of actors of the state, the health service, the education service, and the tax system working in conjunction. If I have a hope for what I would describe as active labour market policy, it would be that comes back into vogue. Because we know it works.
We'll have to see how it goes. And if we zoom out a little bit on the UK economy, I got a long-term chart here of UK GDP per capita, i.e. per head of population, which doesn't make particularly pleasant reading. So UK GDP per head still below pre-financial crisis levels.
Depressing, isn't it?
A long way down from pandemic levels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interrupted, really, a kind of steady 50-year progression that we had.
Yep.
I'm guessing I should have put a contrast to the US on here. Mm-hmm. But we've also got a couple of charts from our friends over at TS Lombard. Rolling 10-year moving average of UK real wages is negative, and real household disposable income has effectively flatlined for a pretty long period of time, again, having progressed.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I guess, kind of stems back to productivity, and again, another chart from TS Lombard, UK productivity, whilst being modestly better than that in the European, the EU, is nowhere near as good as in the US. Mm. You got sort of a few kind of thoughts on the kind of the big picture, and obviously you've been in policy, but what can we do? Just work a bit harder, work a bit smarter, all of the above?
We could do
AI going to save us?
Well, we could do a whole new, different podcast on this agenda of productivity, but also on per capita measures of GDP rather than necessarily sort of aggregate levels of GDP. One thing I would say is, just picking up on the chart you finished off with, the dichotomy between European economies and US economies, I do think if this is possibly the most interesting part of macroeconomics at the moment, is the degree to which the US, across a whole range of parameters, be it debt costs, debt headroom, productivity, whether it's just playing by different rules to other economies. And the degree to which having the global reserve currency, having the deepest capital markets, but also having those huge tech companies with intellectual property that is sat within the United States, enables a different level of trend productivity growth. I don't think we can draw the conclusion yet, but it's certainly these charts are pointing in that direction. For what it is worth, I would suggest that the UK has very clearly over 3-4 decades underinvested in its capital stock.
Mm-hmm.
It is, if we're talking corporate language, if you had a company in, you would say, UK PLC, you have reduced your capex spending, capital expenditure spending, to boost your short-term earnings. That was the 80s, 90s, early 2000s story. Mm-hmm. But we all know what happens when companies do that, is your long-term earnings are impaired because you haven't invested in your future earnings stream. That's the closest I can get to a single diagnosis of the UK's productivity problem. It has underinvested in its capital stock, and as a result, it is now struggling to generate productivity per head that it had historically after many decades when it was investing much greater amount of its GDP in both public sector investment and crowded in by private sector investment.
And you would think that corporate investment, companies invest, you know, we've had 10 years of interest rates of zero, so you can't say that cost of capital has been an impediment to companies to build a new factory or install some new software.
No.
So what... And I haven't got the data with me, and I kind of wished I had, but, you know, investment has fallen off in particular since somewhere around 2016 in the UK.
You can say the B word.
I could say the B, well, we could do. but, you know, that has also, the politics has also been an issue as well. So, but is there an element that you need, like, an economy that's growing quite strongly to encourage businesses to invest? Because they'll only invest if they can see the demand for it. If the economy is tepid and growth is weak, you don't necessarily rush out and spend a load of money expanding or building another factory or installing some new software or whatever you might do to increase your long-term productivity and growth. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I would make a couple of observations. One, this is a multi-decade thing. So while we have had a disproportionate amount of economic shocks, some self-inflicted, some entirely beyond the control of UK policymakers, and you can think of the fallout from the global financial crisis, you can think of Brexit, you can think of the war in Ukraine, you can think of COVID.
Sure.
That's a pretty punchy set of, if you like, macroeconomic challenges, which, you know, if you're looking for reasons not to invest as a company, that would be, you know, those series of events will give you that excuse. The second point that I'd make is that because it's a 30, 40 year trend, it feels like it's not just that is driving, if you like, the absence of cumulative investment. I do think that while the interest rate environment has been favourable, we also need to look at the fact that why in an environment where private equity and, if you like, startup growth companies have been able to chip away your margins as an incumbent, would you as a big incumbent invest more? I mean, I think there is something about the competitive pressure of low interest rates that has perhaps had a little bit of a disincentive for the big incumbents with big balance sheets to put capital to work, because they're seeing, and maybe it's the legacy of very low interest rates, that it perhaps didn't boost investment quite as much as perhaps we would suggest if it was a linear relationship between interest rates and business investment. So I think also I'm quite cup half full on the outlook for productivity from here, because I do think we've got a better cost of capital environment to encourage investment going forward. It's one of the reasons why, I think you mentioned AI, why there are perhaps straws in the wind on why the worst on UK productivity may well be behind us.
Well, just to let in on our viewers and listeners, I was running a little bit behind schedule for this afternoon's appointment, and AI / Copilot, in fact, wrote your biography for me in about 10 seconds.
Pretty accurate.
Me having to go and look at it and write it myself. So let's hope that AI does come and save the UK's productivity problem.
I mean, part on the productivity point, is part of it, you know, does the government need to be a bit more helpful in terms of, you know, there's lots of hurdles to get over if you're, you know, for big infrastructure projects or for building or it's, you know, it feels like in the UK to, I mean, HS2 is
Hinkley Point, HS2, Lower Thames Crossing.
Do they need to become better stakeholders and actually help companies and, you know, help potentially global investors to pave the way so that things get done? Because it feels like nothing can get done in the UK, which is quite disheartening. And we shouldn't be that negative. But
one data-driven reflection, and one, if you like, just, it's my personal opinion based on, you know, I hope being able to have observed this last couple of decades, how, you know, the economy has evolved. So on the data, You rightly mention if you benchmark our production of high-speed rail or nuclear or the time for energy grid connections versus, you know, you can look at nuclear, the cost of nuclear in France or South Korea. You can look at high-speed rail in well, China's perhaps not the best benchmark, but certainly in France and much nearer benchmark or mainland Europe. And it looks like we have added in disproportionate cost. And some of that is, and I wrote it in one of my recent columns, is we're taking a design for Hinkley, which has been used in other jurisdictions, and we've instigated 7,000 little changes to a model that we know works. Yeah. That just adds cost, adds time. There are obviously, you know, stories about hundreds of thousands of pages of environmental impact assessments for Hinkley, for the Lower Thames Crossing, etc. To some extent, and this isn't just a blind plea for deregulation, it's data-driven. If you benchmark the costs and the times of these things, it looks like we've overdone that. Yeah. So some paring back of that, I think, is pretty... it's pretty much pretty strongly supported by the data of international comparisons. The bit that is a bit more opinion formed, based on my experiences, you mentioned the role of the government as a stable counterparty. We're not short of industrial strategies. We've had lots of industrial strategies in the last 10 years, but that's part of the problem. We've had lots of them. I'd argue we need one. We need to hold it through the cycle. We need to have bipartisan support for it.
Yeah.
And that being the strategic role of government, to be, you know, set its stall out and stick to it. Because private capital, in my view, will crowd in with a stable counterparty. One that says it's going to be there through the cycle. Its strategic priorities, be it on steel, be it on transport, be it on agriculture, they're going to remain the same year in, year out, and therefore you have the confidence to invest.
But the important part you just said is it's bipartisan. It's if there is a change in government, it continues. You know, the project continues. You can't have this. It's in place for, by the time a new government sets its policy in place, you're probably a year away from being elected. You know, you can't have, and then, you know, you're running for an election again in 2.5 years. You can't have a policy for 2.5 years and then it changes.
No.
It's, you know, we're too short-termism, I think, in the UK. We need to be longer term in terms of these projects and investments.
And the good news is there's nothing new that needs to be attempted here. We've got the National Infrastructure Commission. We've had the Industrial Strategy Council, but the latter has been disbanded. The National Infrastructure Commission is not necessarily being allowed to sort of drive those strategic priorities. To some extent, whoever wins the general election, or maybe when this goes out, it'll be the side of the general election, people will know. Whoever has won, maybe if you're listening to this after the general election, absolutely right. Identify the priorities, and to some extent, if you look at the real public policy successes, I know it's not infrastructure, but it's an area I worked on, I'm very passionate about, it's auto-enrollment and workplace pensions. Go back 20 years, and Adair Turner and the Pensions Commission came up with an evidence base that was compelling on under-saving for retirement, and the project that started in the early 2000s ran through the staging of the early 2010s of auto enrollment and then the ramp up of contributions has been an extraordinary bipartisan, to use your word, policy success.
Through the financial crisis.
And if you'd offer, I think opt out rates are still in single digits, contributions have gone up. Well, membership has gone up from high 40s to more than 75%. We should celebrate that as an example of how it can be done. Now, it won't be done on everything, otherwise you diffuse all political differences. But on those big strategic questions, and in that case it was under saving for retirement provision, in the case of national infrastructure and a growth strategy, I do think there's a place for a bipartisan agreement which takes the political cycle out of things, because you need that to get stable allocation of capital from both the public sector and the private sector.
Yeah, it's confidence. It's businesses need confidence to make these long-term, huge investments.
And to come back to that point, I mean, are you, I'm going to ask you, putting you on the spot here, but this is probably going to go out before the election, but are you encouraged by what you hear from the prospective potential Labour government in terms of their willingness to be, as you call it, a stable anchor, a stable agent to co-invest alongside? Are they going to be good news for investment, infrastructure, the stuff that we need?
So economists never give you one-word answers, but I'll say yes.
Good.
with a little asterisk, which is yes, because Securenomics has gone down well as a strategy, because I think most CEOs would say actually the phraseology I've used, the dullness dividend that comes with just, you know, doing good managerial competence in terms of how you deliver governance should generate an upside. It's necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient to getting productivity or growth back to the kind of levels they aspire to. Highest sustainable growth rate in the G7 is not going to be done just through Securenomics. It also has to be done, in my view, on being prepared to make difficult decisions, taking on vested interests. And you can think very squarely on planning in this regard. Where I'm less encouraged is if you look at the manifesto, the Labour Party manifesto on Brexit, which is a thorny issue, contentious issue, you have to take on vested interest, deeply entrenched politics, the type of stuff that may signal how much appetite you have to do this stuff. Brexit does get one mention in the whole manifesto, and it's on, I think, page 117. It doesn't suggest to me that there's huge appetite to grapple with those difficult, complex issues which the previous government have struggled with. If Brexit is the, if you like, the sort of canary in the mine, it's not a great indicator of what is to come.
Yeah, but there's potentially some relatively quick wins on that side of things just by doing like some really boring side deals with the EU on really kind of minor things that just cuts down some paperwork for people exporting or like, you know, potentially that's sounds really dull compared to the dullness dividend thing. But the other interesting thing about the dullness dividend you point that you just made is that we are potentially about to elect a centrist, centre-left, moderate government with a big majority at a time when the rest of Europe politically appears to be in some state of flux, as we're seeing in France, and it's possible that this doesn't go out until after the first round of the French election.
Yep.
But it's, you know, there's an interesting, we've been through 8 years or 10 years almost where the UK has been the volatile political anchor in Europe.
Yep.
And market pricing has reflected that, and we're going to come on talk about the UK equity market, but we've definitely seen it in the gilt market and the Liz Truss moment that we've had. Are we, you know, my view is, and I hope you agree with me, that we're potentially going into the reverse now, where Europe is becoming a little bit more volatile, and the UK might almost becoming a bit of a port in the storm. Is that a fair,
very fair
assumption?
Very fair. And I think, you know, half the global population are going to the polls this year, or have gone to the polls already this year. The UK, for whatever we may think, it's quite fractious politics, I do think there's an argument that both Labour and the Conservatives represent something of a status quo that investors can price. How you price some of the options on the table in the French election, or indeed how you price potentially what could be a very, very, not just politically, but socially fractious US election, are harder to do.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And then I think we'll leave the election and the politics there, unless you wanted to carry on going blindly. But you've done a bit of work on the UK stock market, and you know we keep threatening to get ourselves FTSE 8000 hats to wear on the pod because you know we're softies for the UK market. Yeah. But a few charts just on the sort of the state of the UK equity market. I've got a chart here of total returns on the UK equity market in dark blue versus the US in particular in yellow, Europe in red. We've got emerging markets in grey and Japan, I think they're somewhere as well. But, you know, clearly UK has been a laggard in terms of equity markets since pre-pandemic. Yeah. Like a good fund manager, you produced a chart recently, similar chart, but you changed the start date, which for our viewers and listeners is our classic fund manager. Oh, you just changed the start date to suit the narrative.
Yeah.
But since the start of 2022 and effectively the outbreak of war in Ukraine as a sort of starting point, the UK equity market has actually been one of the strongest globally, predominantly because of the performance in 2022. But you know, it's fair to say that the UK market over the last 10 years or so, if you look on a long-term horizon, has been something of a laggard. And you've also prepared some charts on valuation. So if we move to the next chart, if we look at valuation on the UK equity market here, you know, it's pretty low relative to history.
Yes.
And it's on a big discount relative to the rest of the world. So this, the blue line here shows the valuation on the UK as a composite versus the world, and the green red bars show the spread, premium the discount, premium discount, and it's on a, you know, as big a discount as it's been.
Mm.
Some of that you've explained, and again, I'm going to run through these relatively quickly, but we've got a chart here of the sector weightings on the left-hand side, and what you've rather cleverly done is you've adjusted the weight, the valuation on the UK equity market for the different sector weights.
Yes.
And you've come up with a figure of the UK market being on a 17% discount
yep.
to the rest of the world on a sector-adjusted basis.
Mm-hmm.
How do we think that that closes, if it does close or if it doesn't close, and how have we got here, and what can we do about it?
Well, first and foremost, can I say you should be doing my client presentations, because you summarise some of my equity valuation stuff much more succinctly and clearly than I often do. But thank you for sort of sharing those charts. Look, I've been writing about this for at least 8 years since the Brexit vote, where the discount emerged.
Mm.
And events, macroeconomic events, have come and gone where the opportunity for that discount to close...
We'll just put that chart back on, Alex. We'll hold it up for a minute.
So ...has presented itself. And then these events have happened and the discount has not closed. So I guess I've drawn the conclusion that this is not macroeconomically driven. This is policy driven.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps triggered by a political or economic political event, i.e. Brexit... But then, if you like, started to feed off itself in terms of flows. And I think this is, look, I don't want to bore listeners, but the UK has now become less than 3% of the global benchmark, 3 or 4%, depending on which metric you use, but a small single digit. And as a result of the UK pension industry increasingly moving to a global mandate, they are pulling equity out of UK strategies and putting it into global mandates. If that feeds off itself in something of a doom loop, then the good news, if you like, is that a doom loop that feeds off itself can also become a virtuous loop where it feeds off itself in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires, which is your question, it requires a stimulus. Now, is that stimulus going to be a change of government? I doubt it.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a pickup in productivity growth? I doubt it. But what I do think is we're starting to hear more about addressing what is a contentious issue, a very contentious issue, about pension funds allocating a de minimis to UK equity
mm-hmm.
in return for about £60 billion of tax relief that mm-hmm. is doled out from the Treasury to incentivise savings.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that we have to look at all parts of public spending in a full economic way, not just on incentivized savings, where you should be regionally agnostic. If you think the best returns are Nvidia and US tech, put 100% in it. That's absolutely rational and sensible for you as an individual.
Yep. Yeah.
But as a public sector, as a government, as a trying to grow the economy, increase the well-being, we have to look at it. Well, what does that allocation of capital at an individual level that is rational due to the cost of capital for UK companies and the UK economy. Looked at that through that lens, being entirely agnostic of geography is less of a rational conclusion if you're raising the cost of capital for UK companies. So I think we're starting to move politically to a place where both Labour and the Conservatives are more comfortable getting on board with being a little bit more prescriptive and over-allocating to their home market.
Mm.
And they're drawing on parallels from Australia, Canada. Australia's a good one. The Australian equity market is less than 1% of global equities, and yet their workhorse pensions model, the super fund, allocates 21% of assets to Australian equity.
My sister's got one. She lives out there, and I had a look at it.
Superannuation.
Yeah,
why do they do it? They do it because the Australian government very comfortably says, look, we need to provide a stable cost of capital environment, a competitive cost of capital environment for the Australian economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think Canada was double. I mean, it was 20-30%. They're investing in local Canadian markets.
Correct. And for me, I think the UK has done something which I've written about as being analogous to unilateral nuclear disarmament or unilateral free trade, which is absolutely brilliant if you do it and everyone follows
and everybody
suit.
Else does the same.
But if you have no nukes and Vladimir Putin has lots of nukes, or if you're going down free trade and everyone else sticks on tariffs and protectionism, then the economic outcome for you is not, and the social and political outcome for you is not good. I know that, by the way, I find it deeply uncomfortable talking about, well, I clearly don't find it comfortable talking about it. I am mindful, I'm self-conscious enough that in the seat that I sit in the sector I sit in, that sounds very self-serving.
Yeah.
So I only ask the listeners who go, God, you're talking your own book, because of course you benefit if that happens, to say, does the economic argument, the thesis I've just laid out in the last 2-3 minutes, does that stack up on first principles? If you disagree with me, fine. But attack my working or my thinking,
yeah,
not necessarily, although I'm fully aware of it, because of the seat I sit in.
Well, we're not going to accuse you of that in the slightest. I mean, the libertarian in me suggests that you shouldn't be telling me how much of my portfolio I should put in UK equities. But no. That's what they do in Australia, and I've seen it firsthand. And that, you know, you mentioned Canada, and the US itself has a massive home bias, and they wouldn't countenance...
US pensions are well over 60%.
Yeah.
US companies. Yeah. France is 12, 13, 14%.
And for libertarians...
We're tiny.
Yeah. And by the way, for libertarians out there, where's the path through here? I could quite easily say, all right, if on average, I mean, it's not an average, but let's say 80% of the allocation you have is your allocation, 20% of it is tax relief. The government does have the right, or the state has a right, to have a strategic say on that, let's say 20%, on where that gets allocated. So the libertarian says, fine, you want 80% NVIDIA, crack on. But I think we should be looking through a full economic lens of the impact of that other 20%, because it isn't actually... your individual
it's not your money.
It's there'll be people shouting at their tablet or their smartphone or whatever device they're listening to, saying it is my money, but the state has a role on all allocation of public funds and how that is allocated.
Do you know what? I don't actually think that's the case, certainly from our client base. Is most clients have a home bias, and most clients like to invest in companies that are close to home, ones that they are, you know, are aware of, whether that's Marks and Spencer's or Next or BP and Shell. And I don't think, you know, it's not hard to argue we live in the UK, we should be supporting UK businesses.
Asset and liability matchup.
I'm not, if someone said you've got to invest 100% of your pension in UK assets, that's very different.
Don't forget anybody's,
I think supporting your, particularly living in the UK, you've got children, family in the UK, is for the future of the UK, we should be supporting domestic companies.
Yeah. So you're presumably you're fully in support of the BRISA, the British ISA announcement, which presumably going to go to consultation, long grass, and may never see light of day, or
I'm not sure about that. I am supportive of the BRISA. Although I think, is it going to move the dial? You know, you had a chart there on outflows, monthly outflows, cumulatively over the last 12 months, outflows, those red bars, about £13.5 billion. What do I think a British ISA could do in terms of incremental allocation to UK equity? Probably £1 to £2 billion. So fairly small beer, certainly isn't going to turn those red bars into green bars at the current run rate. But I do think that's why the line in the last budget around pension funds disclosing their ownership of UK assets, which is probably rolling the pitch for a de minimis allocation. I think that could be far more impactful. The BRISA is a bit more of a sort of signalling of intent rather than a material shift in flows.
No, 100%.
Surely a lot of these outflows have, you can't say they've happened, but
was that the AOL Time Warner
we talked about that. Asset allocation?
Yeah, we did. I think the it's hard, isn't it? But it, you know, again, you look at the ownership of the UK stock market, and the largest owner of UK stocks are foreign investors now. So it's I think. The outflows from UK pension funds surely have to stop or have stopped.
And by the way, international investors want to own more. I was in the United States marketing on UK equities and the UK economic picture back in March. Met every single US fund manager I met, and maybe there's a selection bias of who I met, wanted to own more of UK equities because, God, it screens cheap.
Really?
There's some really good companies. But they said, if you guys don't want to buy it, we'll crowd you in, you start buying, we'll buy in, because it's a big discount and it can move a lot. But we need, if you like, something of a first mover, a domestic first movement, to then crowd that in.
Also, it can move quickly because volumes are not the same size as they are in the US.
No, you know, volumes are thin. Private equity, you'd argue, have been the first buy.
Yeah.
So what are we up to? Half a dozen.
Yeah.
Probably year to date, if not more.
I mean, every week it feels like there's
something. Yeah.
This year.
Mm-hmm. So that tells you the undercurrent is that UK equities are cheap and they're needlessly cheap. And I think a little bit of move on the policy front might well. And again, are you happy that a Labour government are going to stick to the similar script in terms of encouraging you?
Fewer ideological hang-ups. There are fewer pure libertarians. And by the way, that isn't weasel words about libertarianism at all. It is that we live in the world we live in, not the world we want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to live in a world where we could unilaterally nuclear disarm. I'd love to live in a world where we can reduce all trade barriers to zero. Mm-hmm. I'd love to live in a world where every economy runs a domestic equity market without any home bias of allocation. Mm-hmm. None of those three things are true.
Yeah.
And therefore, we must live in the world we do live in. And I think Mario Draghi, the former sort of governor of the ECB, talked about in a speech back in the spring, which is, Europe has to recognise that they may think that there are certain rules. I'm paraphrasing him, I'm maybe bastardising his quote, but he effectively said, there are rules of the game, but certain jurisdictions, and I think he was calling out China, but also the US, are not playing by those rules.
Mm.
And Europe needs to recognise that and respond, rather than raging against the lack of observation of rules. Now, some people would say that might be hypocritical, but I think it is an observation that, as I say, I go back to perhaps my point, which is the world we live in is not as simple and pure and straightforward as some of the libertarians like to believe.
Mm. Indeed. May we live in interesting times, Simon. thank you for your time today. There'll be much more to discuss, so we'd be delighted to have you on again.
I think we've definitely got to have you back.
6 to 12 months and find out what's happening. But I think we'll call it a day there for today. And
we can always do an away trip as well.
We can do an away
trip.
To do
You come to Roadmaker Street. You'd be very welcome.
Not when it's 28 degrees outside.
No.
Wearing a jacket. But thanks everybody for watching and listening today. Any questions, get in touch. He's James.Hughes at quarterchevia.com and I'm Jonathan.Raymond at quarterchevia.com, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks very much.